It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest pediatrician says the most important prescription he gives to parents and children is to read every day.
First, Department of Veterans Affairs Chief Eric Shinseki resigned today amid criticism over widespread problems at VA hospitals across the country.
The resignation came just hours after Shinseki, a retired Army general, promised to fix what he called a systemic lack of integrity at some VA hospitals.
With us today for analysis is Tom Shoup, Vice President and Editor-in-Chief at Government Executive Media Group. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Great to be with you.
Well, following the news of that internal review today, was the action taken by the president, the resignation offered by Aaron Shinseki, a surprise?
No, not really. This has really been building for the past couple of weeks and really accelerated yesterday and the day before with the release of the Inspector General's interim report that confirmed many of the whistleblower allegations about long wait times at the Phoenix VA hospital. So at that point, the die was sort of cast.
Yeah, the die was cast, and the president accepted his resignation with regret. And so now there is an interim leader in place, as I understand it. But I'll tell you, after just sort of seeing the outline of that internal report, it sure sounds like there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, there really is. And that's just one element of the huge VA bureaucracy that whoever gets this job next has to manage. It's one of the more thankless jobs in government. It's a very big, very sprawling agency with a diverse mission and a huge upcoming problem with an aging veteran population that are already on the rolls and an expected huge influx in new veterans as people leave the military over the next few years.
And so the other issue that we haven't talked about yet has to do with politics, of course. The president was on the hot seat here. Shinseki, you could argue, took the fall. Is it going to be enough that, from a political standpoint, to sort of keep the wolves at bay, or are they going to keep howling?
I think it'll take a lot of the pressure off because in all of these situations, the first thing that happens is people demand that heads roll, and that pressure just keeps up and generally intensifies until there's a big resignation. So once that takes place, it does take some of the pressure off. On the other hand, this is a hot-button issue, clearly a big problem, one that probably goes deeper than we already know, and there are many people on Capitol Hill who are more than willing to go to bat for veterans and are going to be keeping an eye on this for quite a while.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, a couple of other issues there, including the whole aging veteran population. We have the veterans returning from Afghanistan and Iraq and all those things sort of piling up. Take us through this for a second, because at first, when we heard about the news from the Phoenix VA Medical Center, it was being characterized as sort of an isolated thing, and internal reviews have taken place, and now where do we find ourselves?
Well, it looks like things are more widespread. Certainly, judging from what Secretary Shinseki said this morning, there was sort of hints in what he was saying that this was a systemic problem, that this was going to go deeper, and that this occurred across the board. And that's what's going to be interesting to see, just how deep the problem was and how high it went. And this is where, you could characterize Secretary Shinseki as having taken the fall. On the other hand, a big question is, did people at the highest levels of VA listen if those below them told them that the setting of a goal of 14 days waiting time was just unrealistic? If they did, then they bear some of the responsibility for all the problems the agencies had.
And given the attention being focused on it, I find it very difficult to believe that if that is the case, that it's going to remain hidden for very long.
No, I don't think so. And we've just seen the beginning of the Inspector General's report. So they've only done a preliminary report. There's an internal report being done by the White House, by Rob Neighbors. And then certainly there will be more congressional hearings. So there will be much more to come on this.
Yeah, there's going to be much more to come, but you raised the specter of congressional hearings. And we've talked a little bit about the politics in place here. And it's going to be impossible, I think, to separate the politics from this. But at the end of it all, there are very real issues that are going to have to be fixed. And as we go through the politics of an election year, how is that going to impact the process of actually addressing some of what appear to be some systemic issues?
Well, the short answer there is that the political system, under the best of circumstances, is not very good at addressing management problems in government. In this case, what you see already is the only real way that people have proposed to address the problems that have emerged is to make it easier to fire people and to get rid of the people at the top and fire whoever is responsible, which may be a justified response to what had gone on, but it doesn't address how you fix the systemic issues if there are such issues. So that's going to be – this is not the kind of thing that members of Congress have shown a lot of interest in over the years. So it's an open question as to whether they are going to be able to pay the kind of sustained attention to it that will result in legislation that will actually address the issues.
And do you think this is an opportunity for some sort of bipartisanship? I mean, it seems to me that Democrats and Republicans can unite over the issue of veterans.
I think they can as much as on almost any issue. Everybody wants to be pro-veteran, and no one wants to be seen as being against veterans. So I think there is very real possibility here for bipartisanship. The question is whether or not they'll just be engaged in an effort to see who can get the most ink and out of the idea of just simply getting rid of people, or whether they'll be willing to grapple with some of these more serious management issues.
Now, as I understand it, the deputy there is now the interim head of the VA, and one of his charges is to look for the new successor to the secretary's position. Any speculation on who that might be, and what kind of qualities are we going to be looking for in that person?
It's a little early to speculate. There are some names being thrown around, like former Senator Jim Webb, Representative Tammy Duckworth, former Senator Max Cleland. What these people have in common, of course, is that they're all veterans themselves. And I think it's likely that the administration will want to look for someone who is a veteran to go step into the job. The question is, will they be able to find someone who is willing to take the job and who has the kind of experience that it will take to really make reforms at the agency? Because fundamentally, this is a management challenge. Eric Shinseki knew everything that you needed to know about veterans' issues as a decorated multi-year veteran of the military himself and a very high-ranking official. What's less certain is whether he was the kind of manager that the VA needed to really run its operations effectively.
So they'll need somebody with those management chops, but also somebody, I would think, with a fair amount of credibility that's going to be able to have that political heft to get things done, not just, managing down, but managing up, too.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's no question that it's a person who needs to have both of those characteristics, because you have to have credibility on Capitol Hill and among veterans groups. And if you don't have that, then you can't even get started. And combining that with someone who has the management skills, that may be a tricky thing to do. Now, the administration has become more and more cognizant of this in recent months with the healthcare.gov debacle. I think it's becoming more clear to them the importance of getting good managers in government. So I think they know what they're up against.
Well, lots to think about. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Tom Shoup, Vice President and Editor-in-Chief at Government Executive Media Group. Our next guest is a pediatrician who says one of the best ways to boost kids' health and well-being is to give them books.
Dr. Dipesh Navzaria is with us. He's Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's a pediatrician and an occasional children's librarian. Dr. Navzaria, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, I've seen you've written and said in the past that read every day is one of the most important prescriptions you've ever given parents. Why is that?
That is absolutely correct. And honestly, it's because of what education means for a child's health status. People talk about what's the single thing that makes a big difference for a child's lifelong health. And, you know, some say it's nutrition, some say it's exercise. I say it's education, because if you have education, then you're able to access all the things that lead to better health. You're able to have better nutrition. You're able to have better exercise. Success in school pays off for kids. It pays off for their families. And I'm thinking about the long view when I give people that advice.
And when I think about kids and reading, I'm thinking kindergarten or maybe 4 years old. That's too late, isn't it?
I wouldn't say it's too late, but it's certainly you should be starting much earlier. With the program that I'm affiliated with, Reach Out and Read, we actually start at 6 months of age. And actually, I and many of my colleagues feel that we should be starting actually right from the very first days of life, because the early foundational skills of literacy really come from those early interactions. We're not trying to teach kids to read early. I'm not impressed by the two-year-old who's hauling in a copy of Harry Potter or whatever. We're trying to teach them to learn to love books. We're trying to teach them that love of being in their parents' lap or snuggled up next to them, hearing a great story, of the joys of narrative and vocabulary, and having that interaction, even in a busy parent's life, being able to sit down for just even 5-10 minutes at the end of a day and have some quiet, restful, relaxing time together, just being lost in a story, it really makes so much of a difference to their lives.
So we're not dropping Harry Potter in the crib, but what does that look like from the first few days? How should a parent start introducing books to a baby, as you say, in the earliest days of life?
Mm-hmm. It's very simply, you know, read aloud to them. And those early days, just read aloud, you know, and honestly, it doesn't even need to be a children's book. We've had some parents sometimes reading aloud from, you know, the Wall Street Journal or whatever to their child. They're hearing language, and they're hearing language from their parent. And that's really critical. The language they hear from television or anywhere else or from interactive apps does not build their skills anywhere like the language that they hear from a responsive, caring adult or an older sibling. That works too. And then as they get older, letting the child handle the book, giving them a book to play with, to hold, and letting them control it is really critical. They want to look at the book backwards from the last page all the way to the front? Be my guest. They want to open it randomly? That's okay. There's not like there's a one correct right way to read that we want parents to be doing. We want the child to be comfortable with books. We want them to be handling books so that when they start in preschool or kindergarten and the teacher hauls out a book, they say, hey, oh, great, a book, as opposed to what I see far too often, which is a child who looks at that book and says, oh, well, what is this? That child's already behind the eight ball, and that's where the achievement gap has already started. It's not an issue of middle school. It's not an issue of elementary school. It's an issue of the first 1,000 days of life.
We hear a lot about disparities in income, in education. Is there a disparity in books here in the United States?
There certainly is, or more accurately, there's a disparity in home literacy behaviors. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that young children are not being read to and in the same rates between socioeconomic groups. So nationally, about half of children ages 0 to 5 are being read to on a daily basis. Wisconsin, we're just a little bit below that, but, you know, mid-pack. But if you look at the children who are under 200% of the federal poverty line, we actually dropped to only a third. We're actually 49th out of the 50 states in that regard.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Reach Out and Read. You're heavily involved in Reach Out and Read and Read Wisconsin. What do you do?
Yeah. So Reach Out and Read is actually a program celebrating its 25th birthday. It's been around for some time. And it is a program where essentially doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants in the primary care clinic are prescribing reading to families. When they come in for their well-child visits, their regular checkups, starting at 6 months of age and going all the way through to 5 years of age, we give them a book, we ask the families to please share books together, we ask about reading, and really say that this is a great part of maintaining your child's health, setting your child ahead on a future of school success, all these things. And I'll tell you, you know, when those families come back at 15 months, 18 months, and I ask, so, do you have a chance to share books together? I love it when they look at me and say, yes, we do, because you told us to. And I watch what that child's doing with the book, and I say, wow, I can tell that they know what this is, and there's a look of joy on their face. We've done our job then.
And this is part of your assessment, as I understand it, as a pediatrician. One of your diagnostic tools, I guess, is to hand a kid a book.
Exactly. You know, if Reach Out and Read was merely a book giveaway program, you know, we could just mail a bunch of boxes of books to a clinic, but it's not. We have a training program, which all of our healthcare providers do go through, and they are trained to hand the book directly to the child at the outset of the visit, watch what the child does with the book, watch what the family's response is. When that four-year-old grabs the book from my hand, they run up to me, grab it, start flipping the pages and say, oh, if you give a mouse a cookie, oh, I love this book. What have I learned? I've learned gross motor skills because they ran up to me. They turned pages. I've learned about their fine motor skills. I heard language. I know about vision. I know they're being read to. I've done most of my developmental surveillance, and it took me about 6 seconds, huh. and I could see it for myself. I said this once in a federal congressional briefing. In a well child visit where there's no other identified complaint, I would rather walk in without my stethoscope than without a book, because I learned so much more from watching that child with a book, and I learned so much more about their family.
How widespread is Reach Out and Read here in Wisconsin? Is it catching on?
It certainly is. The first program was founded back in 1997 in the La Crosse area. And when I arrived in Madison in about 2006, there was about 30 programs throughout the state. We got up to about 55 programs that just popped up on their own. And then in 2010, we founded Reach Out and Read Wisconsin, which is our statewide agency to help support Reach Out and Read. We're about to break 100 clinics, and we have another 30 or so in application. People are hearing this, and it's catching on, and it's really, really sparking and lighting a fire in many communities, not just in the healthcare providers, but in the public libraries, in the United Ways, and others who are saying, we want to come together as a community with our clinics. And it's great to see that wonderful coming together in communities to build capacity around this program.
I want to get to our callers in a minute at 800-642-1234 if you want to talk about kids and reading, maybe your personal experience. But before we do that, I imagine there might be a pediatrician out there or a librarian or a teacher who says, we don't have this in our community yet. How do we get on board? How do they get in touch and get started?
Well, they could certainly start by looking at our websites. The National Reach Out and Read website is at www.reachoutandread.org. And the Reach Out and Read Wisconsin is a program of the Children's Health Alliance of Wisconsin, which is at chawisconsin.org. There's information on there about wherever current sites are. If it's not in their community, they can certainly contact us via the email on that website and gain more information about it.
We'll bring Deborah in Berlin on the line now. Deborah, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm just nodding my head in agreement and support of getting children to have books. I'm the state coordinator for Wisconsin Association of Home and Community Education, and we are beginning our 17th year of Wisconsin Bookworms. We cooperate with UW Extension Family Living Programs and Wisconsin Public Television, and we get books to kids. We are approaching 700,000 books that we've given to children in the last 16 years. Our volunteers are active in 43 counties in Wisconsin through Home and Community Education. We go by the initials HCE, and we visit children in their classrooms, 4Ks and Head Start, some daycares, some library programs, and we give a set of 8 brand new books each school year to these children. It's a fantastic program. All grassroots. Our readers are all volunteers. We raise the money to pay for the books, and about 100% of the funds that we do raise go to buy the books and supporting materials.
All right, Deborah, I want to cut in because we're closing in on news time, but another program out there looking to get books in kids' hands.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful. And, you know, again, it's not just about the books. It's about the quality advice that's being provided by the home visitor, by librarians, by school teachers, by the healthcare providers that really enhances that message. Because for many of the families we work with, honestly, there's often this little voice in the back of their head saying, you know, I didn't do so well in school. What is my child going to learn from me? Aren't they better off in front of this, quote-unquote, educational DVD or this educational app? This really says to them, we believe in your ability to help your child, and we believe in your ability for your child to learn something from you, because parents are their child's first teacher.
We're talking to Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria about the benefits of reading and literacy for kids. He says read every day is one of the most important prescriptions he's ever given, and there's really no point at which it's too early to start reading to kids, to start getting benefits from that.
You can call in and join the show, 800-642-1234. How important was reading in your childhood? And do you find it to be important for your kids right now? If you're in early childhood education, if you're a librarian or children's health care, do you see that connection between good health and reading? Are you seeing that connection, and are you helping to promote reading for kids?
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about books and kids. Our guest pediatrician says one of the most important prescriptions he's ever given is read every day.
Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria stays with us, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Share your thoughts on kids, reading, maybe your personal experiences too. Again, 800-642-1234. Go back to our callers. We've got David in Soldiers Grove. David, hi.
Hi. I have a question. I have a daughter. She just graduated pre-K, and I will admit that due to my work schedule and likewise with my wife, I'm not able to read to her on a daily basis, and I haven't. And, I mean, I need to find the time to do that. I work with her on other things. I just don't read to her as often. Have I greatly hindered her ability to, you know, read with that ability in the future by not reading to her on a daily basis? You know, she's 5, she'll be 6 in December, you know, or outside of immediately picking up and reading to her again, what can I do to reverse any damage I guess I've done, if there has been any?
Well, let me just reassure you that I don't think you've automatically done damage there. The fact that you're involved and engaged with your daughter is actually one of the most important things. I'm on the American Academy of Pediatrics Early Brain and Child Development Leadership Group, and the main thing we emphasize there is the importance of nurturing, supporting relationships between caregivers and their children. And books and reading together are one of the ways to accomplish that. So you've done something terribly important, which is to spend time with her and be around her, and to make sure that when you are with her that you're present in the moment with her. Certainly, I think even if there's not daily reading happening, that's still something that you've managed to do some of the time. The other thing I'd say is that starting to intentionally set aside a little time, again, only 5 or 10 minutes, is really wonderful for her. So if you can carve out that time to read together with her, then you've really helped her build those skills, build that intellectual curiosity that she needs, and that will serve her well throughout her school time.
All right. Good luck, David. Not too late to start. It makes me wonder, too, about modeling. In addition to actively reading to kids, does it matter if children see their parents reading stuff?
I think the modeling is critical in actually any behavior. It's not just around reading, but also around, you know, electronic usage, smoking, drinking, you know, all those sorts of things. Our actions speak louder than words. So when children see their parents reading, looking at print material, et cetera, it says to them that this is a normal way to be an adult and a normal way to exist, and they're more likely to do those things.
David, thanks for the call. We've got Greg on the line in Waukesha now. Greg, hi.
Hi, Gene and Rob and Doctor. How are you guys doing today?
Really good. What did you want to bring up about kids and reading?
Well, wanted to talk about, first of all, I don't read a lot right now, probably because there aren't a whole lot of books that are in Braille. I am totally blind. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to mainly talk about, and I'm an adult, by the way, but I wanted to mainly talk about the little free libraries that are popping up all around. They seem to be becoming a very popular thing. And I, as a columnist for a local newspaper, I just did a story on some of the little free libraries in Waukesha and here. And there are some really good resources to be found. Mm-hmm. And I just want to encourage people to give and to take.
All right. Greg, I want to get a response from Dr. Nafzaria, one of a new resource, really, for finding reading material.
Little free libraries are wonderful. There's one in front of my own house, and one of the co-founders is a good friend and colleague of mine and sits on our advisory board. I think they're a delight to have as a neighborhood resource for people to indeed exchange reading material, and the delight of watching people walk by and explore is wonderful. But again, you know, there's so many children growing up in our country for whom even the thought of picking up that book, of opening that little free library and taking a book from there, is not something that they do. And that's why we try to send that message so fervently in what we do and Reach Out and Read.
It doesn't matter, I imagine it matters a little bit, what we're reading to our kids and then what they pick up and start reading. How do we know what's the best stuff for them?
You know, that's a great question, and there's a lot of difference in what's out there in children's literature. There's certainly high-quality literature, and then there's stuff that's, frankly, on the order of advertising for toys and things like that. And I think the best answer to that, because I get asked this a lot, what's your favorite books right now, et cetera? Go to your local public library. There are librarians there who live the stuff day in, day out. They know what the highest quality books are. They can point you to them, and there's more than anyone can ever read in their lives, and they get them for you for free. What a great resource. So that is actually where I'd point people. You know, just go to your local public library.
But does it have to be educational? I know I learned a lot of my letters and numbers and some math skills from baseball cards. A lot of my reading early on was in comic books. Mm-hmm. Is it better some reading, even that kind of stuff, than no reading at all?
Actually, I think any reading is generally a good thing. If you look at there's some work that's been done on rare words per thousand, so how really rich and diverse the vocabulary is in certain types of material. And a content-appropriate comic book has much more diversity in language than actually any television script for adults.
Oh, interesting.
Not even for kids.
Wow. All right, we'll go back to our callers. We've got Burhan in Milwaukee. Burhan, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I wanted to make a comment, I guess, more so than just a comment, a question. Lately, we've been reading a bit at night because we started a series of unfortunate events. Mm. But for a long time, we actually sort of avoided reading to our kids at night. And instead, we would just tell them stories and, you know, have the older ones also tell stories, because it's sort of a good way for them to wind down. And you don't have to have a book while they're laying down where they jump up and they want to see every picture and things like that.
But you're not going to argue against that, I bet, Dr. Nafzaria.
Not at all. And I think it's wonderful that you're able to share stories and be creative in that way. And, you know, I also say for families that may have trouble kind of figuring out how to smoothly tell stories in that sort of oral tradition, there's nothing wrong with audiobooks. Audiobooks allow children and adults, too, to turn off that difficult job of visual text processing and enjoy vocabulary, enjoy narrative, and all those things. It's not cheating to do that sort of stuff. And some of my favorite times have been actually long road trips with my kids where I've turned on an audiobook and I've barely heard a peep out of the back seat because they're enthralled by the great story, because it's great literature we're listening to, and we've driven 10 hours and gotten through a beautiful novel, and I'm like, wow, that was so easy.
Amazing. That's a great idea. Burhan, thank you so much, and I hope your family continues to enjoy some great storytelling. I will go now to Brenda with us in Green Bay. Brenda, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I really... agree with everything the pediatrician has said, but one thing I would like to add is that I know that the language that's spoken in homes by adults is different in families that are is it different across families, and some families tend to speak more in command language, and some families do more of the narrative talking where it's, you know, look at that bird and what do you think that bird is doing and those kinds of things. And I know that there are programs that also look at helping parents know how to talk to their children so that when they're out on a walk or they're in the car or something like that, they can take advantage of situations where they can have that kind of narrative talk where they can speak themselves and then allow their children to speak about what it is that they're thinking. I just was interested in hearing your guest comment about that.
Oh, interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a wonderful observation. And certainly the quality of the interactions, the verbal interactions between parents and children is very important. And that's actually the one of the reasons we advise families to share books together, because if you think about a stressed out parent who's, you know, working multiple jobs and trying to make rent payments and get food on the table and you know, do all these things, that 5 or 10 minutes of sharing a book together may be one of the few times that the child can hear their parent in a non-stressed out voice speaking in a different way and realizing, okay, my parent can do this, and that is there underneath all that household and home stress. So while I agree with those programs and I think they're a great idea, it's often hard to scale that to the number of families that really need it. So if we can offer that in some small way, that's one of the things we do at Reach Out and Read, is we're helping build those stable, supportive relationships in a scalable manner. But I agree with you that the children, not only they should have high quality interactions when possible, but they need to have those interactions. There's a 30 million word gap between children living in poverty and their more affluent peers before the age of 4. That's 30 million fewer chances for those brains to wire as well as we want for them to be ready for school. And it needs to be words from people, not from products like iPads and TVs and so on.
You mentioned this at the outset. Now at the close, what is at stake for a kid now? What does their adult life look like if they get these books, if they get that reading from their parents right off the bat? Mm-hmm.
And remember, it's not just the books. It's that interaction mm-hmm. at home. So if their parents are able to follow through, read with them, make sure that their screen time is minimized, what they're doing is they're setting up a child who on the first day of preschool or 4K or kindergarten, when the teacher hauls out a book, says, they say, "Ooh, a book," and they look forward to it. They may know the basics of some letters. They may be able to, and they know about narrative flow and rhythm. They know how to handle books, and they're already on their way. Because by fourth grade, if they don't have these reading skills solidified, it's really hard to recover them. I'm not saying it's impossible, but up to fourth grade, you're learning to read. After fourth grade, you're reading to learn. And our education system can't offer you much if your literacy skills are poor, and then there's everything that comes with educational failure after that. What I love about Reach Out and Read is that it's efficient, it's fast, it makes our well-child visits better, and it offers so much for families, and it says to families, we believe in you and your ability to help your child and your child's ability, and that's a really affirming message for them to hear.
Dr. Nafzaria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria. He works with Reach Out and Read Wisconsin. He's assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, a pediatrician, and occasional children's librarian.
It's time for our state news roundup now, and lots going on this week again. And it ranges from the legal battle over Wisconsin's proposed abortion law to developments in the John Doe campaign probe. And joining us now to fill us in on the latest is Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. Hey, Noah.
Good afternoon, Gene.
Well, as I say, lots to talk about this week. And let's start out talking about this hearing that we've been hearing so much about. This mm-hmm. goes back to a relatively new law in Wisconsin, which requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges.
Right. And specifically at hospitals that are near clinics where they practice. This is a law that I believe officially passed in 2013, but has been held up in the courts essentially since then. And this is a hearing that's been going on most of all this week. In fact, it just wrapped up just a few hours ago. Backers of this bill at the time when it was passed, as well as witnesses that were in support of the legislation or in support of the new rules during the hearing, they testified and basically to the extent that they say, you know, this law is an effort to maintain the continuity of care if there are complications and a woman needs to go to the emergency room following a procedure. For supporters of the law and others, essentially this is a way to make sure that that women have medical support if they were to have complications.
And this law is not specific to Wisconsin. There are other cases of this around the country, right?
Yeah, this actually is a strategy that's being used nationwide by pro-life groups and lawmakers to, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, restrict the access to the procedure by forcing clinics to close. Because in several cases, including in Texas and possibly here in Wisconsin, hospitals aren't granting admitting privileges to doctors. And if they can't get those privileges, then the clinics can't have doctors, therefore the clinics close.
So this week at the trial, the state, of course, being represented by the State Department of Justice, what are their arguments? What have they been presenting?
Right. So the lawyers for the Department of Justice have basically said, again, like many supporters of the law, that this is really an effort to maintain that continuity of care. You know, at least one clinic here in Wisconsin say they will close if the law is upheld. You know, during the hearing this week, providers argued that they have tried but failed to obtain those admitting privileges that the law requires them to get. And supporters of abortion will say it's the very safety of the procedure that actually prevents the doctors from getting admitting privileges because they don't steer enough patients to the hospital because complications are relatively, you know, there are seldom complications.
So, of course, lots of witnesses on one side or the other. But something unusual this week, I'm sure it's happened before, but I hadn't heard of it. But the judge essentially convened a panel of his own experts.
Exactly. One that supports the law, one that is essentially against the law. And this is the interesting part. A third part of this panel was appointed by the judge himself and was supposed to be sort of a neutral party that can testify to the law's legality.
So the hearing actually, it wrapped up today, right?
It did. The hearing wrapped up today. The decision is expected sometime next month, although I have to say that, you know, this is a hot button issue. And if it were to be thrown out, if the law were thrown out, you know, my guess is chances are it wouldn't end here. It would probably make its way to the Seventh Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court of Appeals, and then possibly even on to the U.S. Supreme Court. So
lots to watch there. Any clues as to what the judge might be thinking, or is that something we have to wait for?
Well, before adjourning, Judge Conley did suggest that he was troubled by the law's inflexibility. He cited the fact that it forced providers to get privileges within 3 days of when the law went into effect. And he said that the law could also affect efforts to recruit new providers. He conceded that it's already hard to find abortion providers, and this law will make it that much harder. And so certainly this is a judge that I think is looking at this law critically. Of course, we don't know how he's going to rule at the end, but I think that's at least a testament. Those ending comments were testament to, you know, at least his ambivalence about the law.
And elsewhere this week, we've got more developments in this ongoing John Doe investigation we've been hearing so much about for the past couple of months. And again, I've been confused for the last couple of weeks, and right. I'll be honest, I'm more confused now.
Right. And I think a lot of people are. This is an incredibly complicated, legally complicated case, or really set of cases. Quick refresher, the investigation is looking at possible illegal coordination between Walker's campaign and outside groups during the recall elections. Mm-hmm. The investigation itself was recently suspended by a federal judge who was concerned that the prosecutors were violating the free speech rights of the targets of the probe. That decision has been appealed, but as of now, the investigation is currently on hold. Now, since then, we've had some developments.
And the big development that I saw this week, first published in the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, apparently Governor Walker's campaign allegedly in settlement talks with prosecutors.
Right. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. And in the opinion pages, the journal actually also criticized the governor, saying basically that, you know, he has to choose which side he's mm-hmm. on. And so it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. The governor's campaign, in a very carefully worded statement, said that because they aren't part of this federal lawsuit, they actually aren't in a position to negotiate anything. The caveat being that any settlement in this would likely happen in state court. So if, in fact, there are negotiations going on with these John Doe prosecutors, it would be happening on the state side of things, not in the context of this federal lawsuit. So technically correct when he says the campaign isn't negotiating, but there is some wiggle room.
Interesting. And through all this story, the Wisconsin Club for Growth has been a key player, and they are back in it.
Yeah, they are actually one of the prime targets of the probe, and they've essentially demanded that the talks end, if there are talks, that they end, because they certainly they cited the judge's decision to suspend the investigation. In their view, you know, if prosecutors are negotiating with the Walker campaign, then that's actually technically part of the investigation. And, you know, for them, it puts them in a weird position because they don't know what the Walker campaign, if they are in fact negotiating with prosecutors, what the terms of that settlement are. They just don't know. And so I think certainly the Wisconsin Club for Growth would be very concerned if those settlement talks are going on and are allowed to continue.
You know, the standard question at the end of something like this is what next? But in this case, does anybody know?
No. I mean, right now, the John Doe prosecutors have asked for clarification from the judge.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know whether or not, you know, these potential talks do violate his order. But the judge so far has not responded. So as far as that debate, whether or not these settlement talks are going on, and if so, do they violate the judge's order? We're still waiting. We're in a holding pattern there.
And turning into other news here in Wisconsin this week, we've been hearing a lot about concussions in the NFL and elsewhere for the last several years. And really, that whole subject has been rising to a new level of attention. And here in Wisconsin, Medical College of Wisconsin has a lot of money now all of a sudden to take a look at that.
Yeah, they just received several $1 million to study sports-related concussions. And as you mentioned, mm-hmm. I mean, this new money comes at a time when sports-related concussions are making headlines. I mean, the NFL has been in a legal battle with former players and their families who claim they were essentially misled about the health risks associated with the sport. You know, players can claim that these concussions in the long term, you know, may lead to dementia, mental health issues, and in fact has led to an increase in suicides among former players. The money that the college is getting, though, is part of a $30 million initiative sponsored by the Department of Defense and the NCAA, and in fact was announced at the White House this week.
So the money coming here to Wisconsin is just part of it. What specifically is Wisconsin's role going to be in this? What's the school going to be looking at?
So among other things, they'll be looking at if there's a way to know when an athlete has recovered from a concussion. You know, they'll be looking at when's the right time for that athlete to return to the field.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for something like, I think, a blood test. I think they'd like to somehow develop. That's one thing. The school, among other participants in this research, will also be looking at how routine sports participation may affect, you know, people's brains over time.
So maybe not necessarily at the level of the NFL, but, you know, high school football, that sort of thing.
Exactly. You know, middle school, high school, exactly. That's the kind of thing they're looking at. In fact, I understand that maybe researchers will actually be, you know, attaching sensors, you know, to helmets and people's heads, essentially, to collect that kind of information.
Trying to measure impacts and see how that affects people over time.
Exactly, right. So a lot of money for some very important research at a time when sports-related concussions are certainly in the headlines.
All right, lots to talk about. You know, in other news this week, the last of the snow finally melted, I think, earlier today in Wisconsin. I think it's finally gone.
Was this up north?
Yeah, it was up north. I'm just making that up. Noah, thanks so much for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks. Enjoy the weekend.
I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do most of it outdoors.
As will I.
Noah Obshinsky is our assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio.